This is Julio Rodriguez, and this is the Lookout Landing Podcast. Guess who's back? Steve. You still doing that shit, Andre? Oh, for sure. Yeah. Check me out. It's still Dre Day, nigga. AK, nigga. Though I've grown a lot, can't keep it home a lot. Cause when I frequent the spots that I'm known to rock, you hear the bass from the truck when I'm on the block.
Hi, everybody. The Lookout Landing Podcast is back. Thank you so much for your patience. My name is Matthew Robertson. I fucked off to Idaho for a bit to do what can only be described as extreme chilling, and it was a great time. You know when your brain is working a little too well and you got to take yourself down a few notches? That's exactly what I did, and I'm glad that it happened. Although I did get a speeding ticket on the way back. They caught me on my Akon shit doing 90 in a 65.
This is what?
So I was in Davenport, Washington, a couple clicks south of nowhere, real easy to drive, super fast. And yeah, it was a classic case of I am in the wrong here. When they pulled me over, I was like, yeah, like there's no debate here. I was going far too fast. State trooper name redacted for his safety. But
I'm sorry,
that's
90.
What happened to me.
90. Like you would have had an argument at like 80, 85. 90, though. Come on, buddy.
Technically, it was 98 in a 70, but
what?
Neither here nor there.
That's so very on, here.
I have places two? To be, Kate.
Oh, man.
98.
You know how it is. You've been on those roads.
I've never once in my life driven a car that could reach 98 miles an hour.
Really?
Like, my 1988 Flex. Subaru could not hit 90. The fuck are you, Fast and the Furious, out here? What is this? What is this?
My life. I'm trying to relate to our audience here with our fast living listeners. I'm sure they've had their fair share of speeding tickets or, you know, shenanigans in Davenport, Washington, a place that totally exists, I found out.
That's not quite deep enough from Spokane to hit the near triple digits, I feel.
Oh,
like.
You know where it is.
I know it's on Highway 2, and I know it's like generally like straight west of Spokane. I had teammates from near there, and yeah, once you get like in the middle of, like, that is prime triple digits area.
Triple digits, come on.
I'm not saying you should frequent it. I'm just saying,
right.
I feel like you, everyone wants to drive 100 once, and then a small section of people want to do it a lot. And I don't,
sure,
but I want to have
sure.
done it
okay.
once. And so that's a great place to do it, where it's pretty straight, it's
yep.
pretty chill.
Yep.
And I'm sorry that you got reined in there, man.
Thank you. That's the correct chill. Answer. That's my philosophy on life. I'm sorry that I got caught as well. Anyway, now I'm back, and I paid basically zero attention to the Mariners while I was gone. So today what we're going to do is have my friends and frequent guests slash co-hosts explain everything that happened. You've already heard them sort of chime in at my failures in life. We got Kate Prusser and John Troop in here. Guys, I basically filed my recap of the Thursday, July 30th game against the Angels and then skipped town. We're recording now on August 5th. Almost a week later, which means that I missed about 10% of the season, unfortunately. So y'all got to help me get back up to speed. First off, though, I guess, how the hell are you guys? It's been a while.
Wasn't it unfortunate?
We're going to find out,
I guess. I don't know if I call it unfortunate.
I mean, I would describe this as the least offensive four-game losing streak I've ever seen. Where, like, they said it was a four-game losing streak afterwards, and I was like, really? I guess it is. I guess they did lose, quote unquote, the 2-3-2 games because they scored fewer, quote unquote, runs than
that
the
being
Athletics.
The technical definition
but,
of a loss, sure.
Look, you know, we
for
could
bookkeeping purposes.
on the jurisprudence of wins and losses.
Jurisprudence? I'm not sure you're using that word correctly.
Very possible. I've heard it both ways. But yeah, it's
okay, Sean.
It was an okay weekend. It wasn't a great weekend.
Yeah, I'm happy
to be back.
We watch
a lot of Psych in this house. There's no other shows but Psych in this house. So yes, it is a Sean Spencer.
I think the reason why I said unfortunate was just because that's a big, like, I want to watch baseball this year, and that was a big chunk to miss. I did see the end of the extra inning game they lost to Oakland, where they had the bases loaded against Soria. We turned that on for like the last two innings, and I saw it all fall apart. And then I was reminded, like, oh yeah, I don't have to do this. Like, that's always the worst feeling, when you turn on a game that's close at the end, 'cause you're like so excited to see them possibly pull it out, and then the opposite happens, and you just are reminded that you could have avoided it altogether. You know, that kind of extends to things beyond life too, but for the Mariners, it just happens so frequently that I feel like I should know better by now. Anyway, so what we're going to do is, I've gathered some headlines from while I was away, and Kate and John are going to walk me through the events that happened to spawn these headlines, because all of this is beyond my, it's beyond the scope of things that I have seen this year. I've heard tangentially about them, and I'm going to try to piece things together. I also maybe should mention that, Kate, you're going to love this too. Like about 3 hours ago, I was bleeding from the head. my work is moving out of our office.
What?
And today was my day. Today was my day to pack my things. So I was like bent down to look at something, and then when I came back up, I hit my head real good on a shelf and just kind of thwacked it right on the corner. So the head was bleeding, but time has passed now and we're all good. So we'll see how the old noggin holds up. But this is going to be a fun exercise in like explaining things to me, both in terms of like, oh, you missed this, here's what happened, and like, here's how cognitive brain function works. So should be a fun episode, guys. I'm excited. I'm excited to go through it with you. The first thing I wanted to talk about, which is something that I had sort of picked up on, I knew that it was an exciting piece of Mariners-dom. The headline that I grabbed is from the Seattle Times. It says, Kyle Lewis showing maturity and poise in his 10-game hitting streak. I'm going to assume each of the hits throughout the streak was a 6-run home run. Is that correct?
Alas. No. But if you're looking for bright spots, like, I would definitely say that Kyle Lewis is one of the bright spots from these early goings with the young kids. Like, we all wondered last year about whether or not what he's doing would be sustainable, and then he changed his hitting profile somewhat this year to adjust to what, actually Joe Doyle has a great breakdown of this on the site, you can go and look for it. But basically, like, they're starting to throw him a lot of off speed, and he has reacted by being able to kind of punch that in for singles. And ultimately, that's not what you want to see Kyle Lewis doing. You want to see him feasting on the fastball, and he's not doing that as much as you hope. But he's been very productive at the plate. So not the 6-run homers every time up to bat, as maybe we expected from the outset of the season, but still very encouraging.
Was it like a pretty pretty varied collection of hits? Like, I'm sure, was there home runs mixed in there? Was he going opposite field? What was going on at the plate for Kyle?
There was some, I'm trying to think of like what you missed, because there was some pull home run. There was some oppo home runs, which is really exciting because Kyle Lewis's ability to hit opposite field is something that he honed in college, where his college had a very, very short right field. So as a right-handed hitter, I think he's a little bit better at hitting, or he's more trained at least in hitting opposite field than you might expect. But yeah, a lot of it is just really, honestly, encouraging. I think, like, taking what the pitcher gives him and doing what he can with it. It in that way reminds me a little of the master of this, which is Edgar Martinez, who was able to read where the pitch would be and direct the pitch to where he needed it to be. So a lot of nice, like, kind of line drives, like line drive singles, right field, left field, spraying the ball all over the place, much more than I would have ever expected Kyle Lewis to be doing. So that's all encouraging. Yeah, we want to see the power.
Yeah, it's a lot of, like, tennis-esque swings almost, where it's like the hits aren't, you know, he obviously he absolutely can clobber the ball on occasion, more than occasion even, but he just has had a bunch of line drives where it's like, oh, this pitch is outside, I hit it the other way. Oh, this pitch is, you know, over the middle of the plate, I loop it up with a, you know, over into over the second baseman or over the shortstop's head. You know, he's the only spot he hasn't really yet been hitting it fully is sort of down and in, and it's very, very encouraging stuff to just see how well he's adjusting to really almost everything, even as, you know, like last night he sort of he hit the ball hard a bunch of times and it didn't all turn in, you know, none of it really turned into a hit. Well, I guess he had one double, but yeah, it is all really better than you would have thought this time last year Kyle Lewis would be given.
Well, that's great. Then the hitting streak is over now, is that correct?
Hitting streak is over. He had an offer on Monday, I believe, and then came back and went 1-for-4 yesterday. Or I guess yesterday being Tuesday.
That is correct. It was an offer on Monday, which was pretty much a bummer in a game that they lost like 11-1. Monday's game was a punch in the throat. I mean, we were expecting losses, but that was a particularly bad one. But then he rebounded with like a really solid double last night, so that was exciting to see.
Gotcha. Okay, tangential question before we move to the next one. How are they handling like rest? Is like, I'm sure like someone like Lewis is playing pretty much every day, but has it been a lot of like cycling guys in and out and moving them around different positions to give certain people days off?
More or less, that's been the case. Lewis was, I think, expected to get a day off on Monday, and he ultimately has not yet had one. But Seager got a day off, I think, on Sunday. They had a lineup yesterday that was over 50% second baseman. You know, with just like, you know, they have a ton of sort of utility guys, and they've been sort of spreading guys around. You know, D's played some left field. D made a sliding catch in left field yesterday. You know, giving some of the other outfielders, you know, some time off. And Daniel Vogelbach is getting a little, even more time off than most. But, yeah, it's been a decent amount of rest.
Gotcha. Okay, let's move to something else that is sort of rest-related, although not by choice. This headline comes from the Tacoma News Tribune. Mariners place starter Kendall Graveman on 10-day IL with neck spasm. First question, do any of you remember a Mariners player ever having a neck spasm or even any sort of neck problem that kept them out of games? Because I don't. Not off the top of my head, at least.
Most recent I remember is Nick Rumbelo had a pinched nerve in his neck.
That's who I was trying to think of. Who had all the neck problems?
Like 4 months of
my least favorite Mariner.
I don't remember any off the top of my head beyond that, but I'm sure there have been some. But yeah, that's the most recent one I recall.
Yeah, I think I've successfully
have a neck thing at some point.
Oh, he might have. I was gonna say I've repressed all Nick Rumbelo memories, but I feel like Nelson Cruz could have had a neck thing. I feel like he had a lot of like issues where muscles that regular people didn't have, he was injuring. Yeah. You know, and that seems like one that would definitely pop up for him.
Absolutely.
Okay, so second question about Graveman. Did this happen during a game? Like, did he have to be removed mid-inning because his neck was barking? Or how did this go down?
No, he gutted through it, which they only said after his start in Oakland. Well, no, they said after his start here that he had had a neck issue and he'd fought through it in Oakland as well. And he was, like, throwing 98. Because he came out the next game and was not throwing as hard as he had previously. So I don't know if he, like, overextended himself now that he feels good and, you know, the arm is back after Tommy John or what's going on. I'm really scared of neck stuff. So, yeah, it wasn't like they took him out in the middle of the game or was anything dramatic. But I'll say that I am very scared of neck stuff just because I think neck stuff is very related to back stuff, and back stuff is just really hard to get past. Like, there's no surgery that you can have. There's nothing that, if anyone who struggles with back pain, like, probably who's listening knows what this is like. I've definitely known people who have broken their back or had some kind of back injury. It can really screw you up. That's why I'm worried about Haniger. I'm also worried about Kendall Graveman. Please get better.
Yeah, that is scary. Have any of you ever had a neck issue?
I mean, other than the fact that I'm old as hell, and, like, if I sleep a little weirdly and I wake up the next morning, like, looking like a fucking Picasso, no, I mean, that's basically it.
I've slept wrong on my neck occasionally and just, like, couldn't turn, but, no, it is nothing nearly as bad as this, where like, it impacted pitching or doing anything.
Gotcha. I think I had a similar thing to what both of you are describing, although maybe to a little more extreme. In high school, I woke up one day after presumably sleeping on my neck all weird and could not turn it at all. Like, I was stuck in one neck position, like, had to go to school the whole day like that. And then after school, got to the chiropractor, which I know, right? It was freaky because I thought I was, you know, untouchable, but the neck gods, for whatever reason, didn't want me to feel that way anymore. So I had, like, a very painful day. And then after school, went to the chiropractor. Shout out to my parents for paying for a trip to the chiropractor. And that shit is unbelievable. Oh, my God. I love the chiropractor so much. I know that, like, they do have, at least in some circles, a bit of a reputation for maybe being, like, quack doctors. I don't know if you guys have heard this, but some people, I think, don't take the chiropractor profession seriously, and I am here to say that they know what they're doing. At least the one that I went to. He got me straightened out so quickly,
right?
And it felt so good. I think it's the best when they, like, take your neck and do that severe
popcorn
crack. It is, yeah, it is terrifying, but there's maybe no better feeling on planet Earth than that. Godspeed to Kendall Graveman. Hope he finds a good chiropractor. He was pitching well, though, right? I think I mean, there was one game I saw before I left where he looked pretty solid, and the velocity is the most encouraging thing. So was it, like, how did they find this neck problem? Was it something, like, that he went up and told them? Do we have any idea? Like, you said it wasn't really obvious during the game, so I'm curious how this led to a full-on IL stint.
Not exactly sure. Sorry, I'm also trying to watch the game, and Max Stassi has hit another home run, which, like,
ooh.
What are you, it's Max Stassi, like, he's not, I'm sorry to say, sorry to this man, but he's not good. Oh, that's a bad
two off Marco, then, because that was the last game I saw, he hit a home run off Marco, so this is just
Stassi,
like,
did?
Groundhog Day for me. Yeah, he
really?
Hit one off the right field foul pole.
Yeah.
That was, right. Oh, that was Marco. For some reason, I thought that was someone else.
Well, the one constant in my life has been Max Stassi homering off Marco Gonzalez.
Oh, my God. What a bad constant.
Yeah. No, Graveman, I don't know that, you know, it was just kind of something they announced after the game. Because he looked fine during the game and, you know, looked even better, honestly. But initially, they were like, oh, this won't be that big a deal. And then they were today came out and said, oh, well, he might miss a couple extra starts. So not ideal, but, you know, does mean we'll get some Nick Margavich's starts. Regrettably, I would love to see some Logan Gilbert starts.
Logan Gilbert?
Like, we'll get that.
Yeah.
Doesn't look like we're going to get that, unfortunately.
But there is another silver lining, which leads us to our next headline. CBS Sports reported this, although I guess lots of people reported this. This was just the headline that I found. So after Graveman was IL'd, they called up Joey Gerber, and the CBS Sports headline says, Mariners Joey Gerber, solid in MLB debut. This is, of course, Lookout Landing podcast guest Joey Gerber. We had Joey on the show while the Mariners were doing summer camp. So pre-big league debut, but I encourage you all to listen to that if you want a look into the mind of Gerb Nation. The only things I know about Joey's actual performance came from his tweet, which was fabulous. He wrote, 4 summers ago, I was playing town ball in rural Minnesota after posting a 7.5 ERA my freshman year of college. Last night, I made my MLB debut and faced Albert Pujols. A lot can happen in 4 years. So that was very touching. That is what let me know that he had made his debut, and then I traced it back to, oh, Graveman got hurt. Oh, they called up Joey. Oh, he did well. So how'd the kid look? You guys, I hope, watched it on the television and saw everything that went down. So I want to hear from you. So Pujols was in there. Did he face Trout at all, or was Trout tending to his baby?
He did not face Mike Trout, but he worked pretty nicely. He was efficient. He hadn't been super smooth in summer camp, but got that, you know, got that LL bump from us, obviously. And I think there was a note about him.
Yes, much like the Colbert bump, there's an LL bump.
Exactly. Just slap an extra L on there. It's us. Yeah, he unfortunately didn't have someone to throw to prior to summer camp, it sounds like. So he was doing a lot of his BP work with a tree, which may have impacted his sort of freshness in summer camp. But he was in the zone. He looked funky. Got some pop-ups, just nice and smooth from Joey Gerber, which is quite nice.
Beautiful.
I would say Gerber is not nice and smooth is not a way you'd describe Joey Gerber.
That's fair.
He is not smooth. But he is a carnival of arms and legs. I mean, he is a Lollapalooza of limbs. He is a Tasmanian devil of body parts just flying at hitters. Mm-hmm. That's what makes him good. And, you know, I was really encouraged to see versus earlier in summer camp when we'd seen him. I'm very high on Joey Gerber. If I wasn't, I feel like Joe Doyle, who is Joey Gerber stand number one, would kill me in my sleep, so I feel almost required to be. But no, he's very good. He's very exciting to watch. But a huge part of that is the deception that he's able to create. So relievers always kind of have a little bit of an edge when they're coming out for the first time because hitters haven't seen them. They don't have any kind of a scouting report on them. They don't know what that pitcher looks like. So I'm sure that was part of it, but also like he came out and I thought he looked dominant. Like he looked mean, he looked nasty. And I don't think generally any at bat against Joey Gerber is a comfortable at bat. I've heard him described as the most uncomfortable at bat in the organization. But it really looked like that against big league hitters, which is a great, great thing to see.
Yeah, I'm also just such a sucker for this stuff, and I'm glad that Joey mentioned facing Pujols in the tweet because Pujols debuted on April 2nd, 2001, which is about a month shy of Joey Gerber's 4th birthday, which is fucking incredible. Albert Pujols on that team, he was playing with Mark McGwire and Bobby Bonilla, which is like another connection to a very bygone era, and now he's facing... Goodness. Joey Gerber, born in 1997.
Oh my God, that's hilarious. And Joey Gerber very, you know, I thought respectfully didn't say that he got Albert Pujols out, but he definitely got Albert Pujols to ground out super weakly, so.
Man.
Viva la youth revolution.
Pujols' BREF still lists him as first baseman, left fielder, and third baseman, which is, I guess, factually correct, but I don't think he's played left field since, like, 2004, maybe. Dude, I would love to see the Angels try Pujols in left field. If they're out of it by the end of the year, let his career come full circle and give him an inning in left.
Did y'all ever read the, like, Three Nights in August, Mike Lupica? Book is like a Cubs Cardinals game or 3-game series in like 2004 or whatever it was.
Like, I have not.
Basically during it, Pujols, like they talk about Pujols getting hurt, basically had like some sort of arm injury where it was like he pretty much couldn't throw, and so they were like, well, it's not really reasonable to have. They like played him one game in left field with it, and their plan was like, if the ball is anywhere near you, like if Jim Edmonds can get to it, just catch it and give it to Jim Edmonds, and then he'll throw it in. And or it's like 2003 or something, and then like otherwise we'll have like Scott Rolen run out to you, or Edgar Renteria run out to you, like whatever it is, like just don't throw it. And then after that, they were like, after one game, they were like, "Ah, we'll just have you play first base. screw this. This is not worth it." But yeah, since Tommy Lasorda, real brainiac. Just don't have a left fielder who can throw. You know.
Wait, Tommy Lasorda was the Cardinals manager?
Not Tommy Lasorda.
Tony La Russa.
Tony La Russa. Sorry to the Italian.
Sorry to the Italian American community.
Hey, who's this guy? Who does he think he is? Tommy, come here. We got a wise guy.
Oh, Matthew, you weren't around, but I sent a tweet because the Red Sox played the Yankees in this. And I haven't felt like, I've just been grateful for baseball, right? But like, the Yankees played the Red Sox on Sunday Night Baseball. A-Rod was the commenter. He said some off-the-wall things, including Gio Urshela is the best third baseman in the AL, which I cannot say without crying and laughter, because he's done things A-Rod has never seen at third base before. Yeah, I mean, he has said some wild stuff. But it just, for some reason, I had this image of, like, you doing both New York guy and Boston guy and, like, heckling yourself through the court. Because I want one Red Sox fan and one Yankees fan just, like, on either sides of the stadium. I think you could do that, like, and still,
I would love to do that.
Maintain social distancing. And just have one on each side just hollering, "Hey, Tony," just hollering at each other from across. That would be content. Hit me up, MLB.
Rob Manfred, if you're listening, I have an idea how we can save the season. He does listen. He actually sent in a question, but we had to cut it because it was nonsensical and really made me question if he even watches baseball. Yeah, Rob, maybe rein it in a little bit. We know you've got a lot of free time because you're not really doing a whole lot to further the game of baseball, but the Lookout Landing podcast is not your outlet for frustration, Rob. No. You've got to find something else. But anyway, I think I remember seeing that at the beginning of the pandemic. Someone pitched that same idea with, like, each team gets one fan and they just scream at each other all game. And I think that would be really great. Also in the NBA bubble, where you can be like right on top of the court basically, and just be screaming, like, because the mic is picking up everything in there anyway. So if we had just people shouting their opinions unfiltered, I would definitely think this whole coronavirus sports revival would be a success. Yeah. And I think the farther we go, maybe we will be able to do that. Maybe they'll open up the one fan system that we've been clamoring for. Who knows?
At last, we can get the like mid game entertainment. Like the halftime show of it's just Spike Lee and Jack Nicholson just taking swings with each other. Just perfect. This is what we've needed.
Sorry, I had to time out of the conversation momentarily to watch J.P. Crawford hit a soft single that Mike Trout dove for and missed. And there is a fantastic still of Mike Trout face into the turf at T-Mobile Park with J.P. Crawford. I'm so here. Please tell me, Matthew, that you have something to ask about J.P. Crawford, because I can't wait to talk about him.
You know, I didn't have a headline lined up, but something that came to my attention today, which is right in my wheelhouse, is that J.P. Crawford, starting shortstop for a Major League Baseball team, is also a huge fan of the band Revolution. Kate, do you know anything about Revolution?
I do, but only because of Isaiah Kiner-Falefa, who plays for the Rangers, who had this really cool walk-up song last year I was like,
oh yeah,
and it was like trust a me, little bit familiar. Surf rock.
Oh, wow, wow, wow. Yeah.
Okay. I'd never heard of. I mean, I'm an old, so I'd never heard of Revolution. I looked that song up. I was like, this song slaps, but it actually kind of doesn't. I think like that.
No, it
hook
doesn't slap at all.
No, they're very anti-slap, I think, as a, from listening to some of their other songs. As
that's what I was going to say. I feel like they would be offended or like feel like they've totally missed their mark if you said any of their songs
slap. If we
described
they're
totally
it
designed
as
to be like, it's like bonfire music.
Oh my God, that's exactly the way to describe it. It's like bonfire music at the beach, totally. Which I feel like is a milieu that J.P. Crawford is very comfortable in. So very into J.P. Crawford dumping a single in front of Trout. And then actually Dylan Moore followed that up by also dumping a single in front of Trout. So just
fuck
real
it,
proud.
Trout.
Real proud of the boys here.
Fantastic. That song, by the way, is called Attention Span. For anyone who wants to...
Attention Span, yes.
For anyone who's trying to up Revolution's Spotify account, you know, they might be in a tough time. Because I saw, so JP Crawford tweeted about them and tagged them. So I went to their profile and saw that they had tweeted like, oh, like 11-year anniversary of this album, which is like their biggest album. And I was like, God damn, like they're probably going through some tough time. Because also like 11 years isn't really like a tweet-worthy anniversary. You know what I mean? Like 10 would make sense. 15, 20. Like, hey, don't forget about this album we put out 11 years ago. We'd love if you listened to it. And so actually, I think I listened to Attention Span whenever I saw that tweet. So I was like, oh yeah, I remember that song. I like that song. But you're right. It does not slap at all. It's very mm-mm, calming. Mm-mm. Very, very Marymore Park music, by the way. I've seen them perform live there. They're a big staple of the Marymore summer concert tour when that was still allowed. I'm sure it's shut down this year.
But I mean, I
they
just
came
feel
through
like
Marymore with like Slightly Stupid, that kind of vibe. They were there a lot.
I feel like JP is, can you imagine like JP as a Philadelphia Philly? Like there is in Fairmount Park in Philly, like there's a big outdoor concert venue where I could like definitely see, I think it's The Man, where I could definitely see something like that occurring, but it seems so much more part of our culture, like the Gorge, and I don't know, we have Saint Michel, and we have so many outdoor concert spaces, and JP is, I think, thoroughly a West Coast kid, and I think he's really, like, he's just kind of in his zone out here, you know what I mean? Like, I just think I feel like he's much more comfortable out here than he ever was in Philly.
You're talking to two people who collectively have spent under a year, I believe, living outside of the West Coast. So, yeah. Yes, we got you.
Yeah, everyone please wear a mask so J.P. Crawford can go to Revolution concerts again. So the last headline, I guess, could kind of be along those lines. I'll segue it in here about someone who looked very uncomfortable at times last year, but now, like J.P. Crawford, appears to be settling in a little bit. This headline is from the Japan Times. Yusei Kikuchi's strong start wasted as Mariners fall to Athletics. This one is something that I also sort of picked up on just from being on Twitter for like 5 minutes. Whatever night it was, my timeline made it very clear that Kikuchi was pitching well, and then, you know, four or five scrolls later, oh, here comes the bullpen, and that's when I was like, all right, I know how this movie ends. But Kikuchi pitching well is great. That's something definitely worth getting excited over, especially against the A's, a team that has good hitters and a team that kind of prides themselves on like good at bats and, you know, heavy air quotes, playing the game the right way, that sort of thing. You're not just up there swinging at everything, trying to get the game over with. So what was working for Kikuchi was the velo up near the 95, 96, 97 we saw in spring training. Like how was his stuff working against Oakland in this game that the bullpen squandered for him?
Yes, is the answer. it was all working. It was, the velo was there again. I think Enosaurus is for The Athletic, been doing a lot of writing, both on velo gains as well as sort of new pitches. And I almost said Seager because Kyle Seager just hit a homer. Kikuchi has covered both those bases. His velocity continues to be about almost 3 miles per hour harder than last year on average on his fastball. And he just has a cutter now that's a good pitch and is like 90-91. His slider last year was kind of a challenge for him, and he's got a wide array of pitches that he's still working on, but the cutter has been both well located and just much more consistent at the same velocity that his four seamer was normally last year. So I mean, it looks like, oh yeah, this is the guy you would go out of your way to sign even when your team is going to be rebuilding, because you think he's going to be a long-term, you know, strong middle of the rotation kind of guy. Like, okay, this is a Yusei Kikuchi. You know, you look at Kikuchi and Marco Gonzalez, you think, okay, there's a rotation here. You know, you've got the buildings of a rotation. You know, obviously you need to see that longer because Kikuchi had good stretches last year, but I mean, this just looks so much better.
Wonderful. Yeah, that seems like the platonic idea of Kikuchi, like what we envisioned when the Mariners signed him.
I would say it's even more velocity than I expected. I expected the secondaries maybe to be a little sharper than they've shown so far. I was not anticipating the velocity for him to just be like pumping 95, 96 plus. So that's pretty exciting. I'm excited to see where he goes from here, which I've been so on tenterhooks about Kikuchi that it's really exciting to be excited about him again.
Yeah, that next start will be, I think, appointment viewing for Mariner fans, especially me, because I haven't really seen him pitch at all this year. And I feel like just that promise of, like, knowing that he can do this can a lot of times outweigh what he actually does. And for that to sort of start reversing is very, very exciting, especially because they're like, true numbers results of this season aren't that important, especially when compared to, like, you know, this is a huge year for the eye test, I guess, to pander to all of our scout listeners. The development and the, like, things that are hard to quantify are things that I'm, like, really more interested in this year than, like, what his final ERA is going to be. Like, if he shows that, like, the velo is here to stay and, like, that cutter that you mentioned is, like, an actual pitch, like, who cares if, you know, he leaves a couple of them over the plate sometimes and they get hit for home runs and that balloons his ERA. Like, knowing that the ability to hit 98 and also dot a cutter from time to time is much more important for me. So that was the headline that I saw that probably made me the most excited. Because I think with, like, Lewis, we know that he's already, like, pretty exciting, and we've seen him do a lot of great things at the major league level. I mean, Graveman getting hurt was a bummer. Joey Gerber, like, solid is about what we anticipated, like, par for the course sort of thing. Like, you know, especially for a reliever, like, one solid inning is about what you'd anticipate. But for Kikuchi to have, like, a fully strong start against a good team was the thing that made me the most joyful upon my return. So thank you, Yusei Kikuchi, for that little spark of joy in this otherwise uncertain time. Should we move to questions now? We got a couple good questions from our listeners, yeah, and I want to shout them out. These are pretty related to some of the things we've talked about, but some of them are not, which is always great. So I want to start with Eamon Smith, at Jin and Yusei, which I believe is a reference to the Nashville Predators Finnish goaltender Yusei Saros, if my Googling skills held up correctly.
What?
Out of the young players, yeah, it's Jin and J-U-U-S-E, and then when you Google that, this goalie named Yusei Saros pops up.
Wow.
Yeah, this guy's maybe a Nashville Predators fan, maybe just a fan of Finnish goaltenders. I don't know, but great
or,
name
or
anyway.
Or just excellent sports, excellent sports punnery, which I appreciate.
Yeah. Yeah, anything is possible. Eamon/Eamon, if you're listening, please let us know where your Twitter handle comes from. But your question was also great, and a good one for me to ask both John and Kate. Out of the young players not named Kyle Lewis this year, who is impressing you the most? I know for me, in the games I saw before I left, J.P. Crawford looked very good, both defensively and offensively. So if you want to piggyback on that and tell me what J.P. has been doing, or if you want to go another route and maybe give some shine to someone we haven't mentioned yet, the floor is all yours to heap praise upon the young players.
I think I have to heap praise upon J.P. Crawford. I mean, we've talked about that, but I was suspect of him when he came over because of the defense, and then he cleaned up the defense, and this year I was like, well, I'm suspicious of the bat, and so far I have been so impressed with... J.P. has always been lauded for knowing the strike zone, and he has really good K-to-BB numbers throughout, but I was just like, is that going to be enough at the major league level? And, you know, I think that J.P. Crawford really has enough. Like, he has enough to be a good MLB shortstop. He's not going to light the world on fire with his power. But he's got, I think, above average power for a shortstop if he can also hold down that defensive side of it. And, I mean, I know Evan White is struggling with the bat right now, but he is such a force field at first base. And I really think it's improved JP's play in a lot of senses, because JP's skills are, he's super rangy, he's super athletic, he can get to anything, and he's just, he'll go vacuum something up and he'll make a throw, and like, maybe it's not the most online throw, but he feels confident in throwing it because he knows that Evan White is either going to take it and make a really good play on it, or he's at least going to keep it from going into the stands and being an extra base. So he's emboldened. I think it's improved his shortstop play. Like, I think J.P. Crawford is like a dark horse, probably not MVP candidate, but I think that there's going to be a lot of national attention on J.P. Crawford by the end of this year. And to me, I just think that's extraordinary, considering kind of Philadelphia essentially gave up on him.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, MVP candidate got me excited. I want to hear what John has to say.
Yeah, I fully agree with Kate around Crawford being the most sort of day in, day out impressive player and exciting young guy. I think, you know, maybe the good way of framing it would be like, if J.P. Crawford can keep this going, like, J.P. Crawford will play in an All-Star game or a few All-Star games, and that would be an amazing thing. Like, that would just be coming out of this year and knowing, oh, we got a shortstop like that. And, like, a good shortstop. Like, that would be so big for the
Yeah,
club.
And, like, taking the pressure off Noelvi Marte having to be a shortstop in the future.
Yeah. So I would put Lewis, obviously, really impressive. I will say I have been really pleased with Shed Long, who certainly has not been, you know, staggering by any stretch, but he's just been really solid and has looked like, okay, you know, he's not an amazing second baseman, but he's made most of the, like, regular plays. They've turned double plays pretty well, and he has just continued to be a solid above, you know, a little bit above average hitter. And, I mean, that is really in concert, those two being just, like, good, dependable players is such a boon to think of. Like, we're watching a middle infield that is going to very reasonably work together and be together for the next 3-4 maybe even more years, and that is a good thing is something the Mariners haven't had in, I mean, other than Gene Segura and Robinson Cano, which right. is a very different combo, you know, that has not been a sort of point of stability for a youth group in quite a while.
And again, I don't think you can underplay the role that Evan White plays in all of this, even though the bat is struggling this so far in his first yeah. exposure to, you know, kind of this higher level pitching. I think that there's a clear, you know, all of his infielders, Shed, JP, even Seager, like, they feel very emboldened to pitch it over to him. And, you know, I think, like, even with Seager, I don't know what his future looks like with the club, but he's hitting. I mean, he's hitting the cover off the ball right now. So he just hit a huge 3-run home run to put the Mariners ahead in this game. Like, you know, if they can just hold on to Seager long enough until Marte is ready, that's still the infield of the future.
I mean, he was on pace to be a 4-win player last year for how well he played. He just, you know, missed the first few months with an injury and, like, continues to be, after his, like, it is still overwhelming just how different he looks physically. Like, he just looks so good. He looks like a better base runner than he did at any point earlier in his career, even. So, I mean, yeah, that is, you can watch almost every single player on the roster right now, really, other than, like, Marco Gonzalez, and think, this guy has something to prove. And I so many of them are proving it so many of, like, the core ones are proving it, that it makes me very happy. I've been really happy watching these games. It's why that when I said, like, the 3-2 losses didn't feel like a 4-run or a 4-game losing streak, like, a lot of the key guys were doing really well. Yes,
I think even Marco, awful, like, honestly, I think even Marco feels like he has something to prove. Like, I don't think Marco feels like he gets the kind of accolades he should get. Marco has a chip on his shoulder, well, and I think he's always trying to, like, go out there and prove that he's better than what people think he is.
I guess I don't feel like I need to see more from Marco Gonzalez. All I need from Marco Gonzalez is for Marco Gonzalez to continue being what he is. I needed
sure,
almost
but I think Marco feels like he has be to show than, more.
Sure, that absolutely, I fully agree with that, and that's part of why he has continued to be successful for despite you know the type of pitcher he is. But like every other player really on the roster had to do more than what they'd done, the year before to make me, to make the club and to make fans and to make people looking and analyzing the team feel like, okay, there's something here. And plenty of them, obviously, since they're 4-8 or whatever, are not performing that well, but enough of them are that I feel good about, what the past week or two has been.
Cool. I want to combine these next two questions because they're kind of in line with what you were talking about, especially regarding Kyle Seager. So we got some trade questions. One of them is from our own Anders Jorstad. Who do you think are trade chips the Mariners could dangle at the deadline? And then Brandon Nichols came in a little more specific. Does the shortened season make it more or less likely for a Seager trade? Or do you see a short-term friendly extension as more likely given the empty hole of third base prospects? So Kate, you mentioned, if Crawford pans out and is the shortstop of the future, that could mean, oh, we can play Noel V. Marte at third base, which then could also mean, oh, we don't have to keep aging Kyle Seager on the roster just to fill the third base position. So I'm wondering if you've thought about this, all the sort of machinations of the left side of the Mariners infield going forward. Seager playing really well so far also makes this kind of an interesting question. So let's start with, do either of you think that Kyle Seager gets traded this year, / does the shortened season make it more or less likely, in your opinion? What do you think?
I think I don't. I mean, Seeger has famously the poison pill in his concert contract, so there are a lot of people who play the position he plays. Like, Seeger's not an attractive trade chip in any way, shape, or form. I think it's really possible now that they just hold on to him and make a long-term deal. Not a long-term deal with him, but, like, make a deal with him that kind of covers the twilight years of his career. He's what? He's 32 now? Is that right? Is Kyle Seeger?
You were asking the wrong person.
32 years
he
old.
He is 32, yeah. He'll turn 33 this winter.
Yeah, so, I mean, what, you're looking at 3-ish more years where he's productive? I mean, I don't know, like...
It's hard to say.
It's hard to say. I think it would be rough for him to go out and get anything better than what the Mariners could presumably give him, as far as, like, a lot of money, a couple of years... he's already pretty well set because of the money he's gotten. You know, at some point I think it kind of becomes about familiarity, and I think if there was a team in Charlotte, North Carolina, we'd be talking about this differently. But there's not. There's not necessarily a hometown team for him to go to. Why not just kind of stick with what he knows? And they have a hole, yeah, and could use him, and, you know, can kind of, like, grandfather him into being the veteran voice on the roster. But he's still, obviously, like, pretty productive. There's a DH spot open. We assume, like, Vogelbach might not be moving forward with the team, sadly. But, like, you know, there's room for Kyle Seeger in Seattle over the next few years, so... I forget what question I was answering exactly, but I think Kyle Seeger stays. It was about trades, right? I think as far as trades go, like, I would say any position player is basically really unlikely. I think if Graveman wasn't hurt, he would have been a really good candidate. Walker might still be a good candidate for a trade. Any of the pieces that they see as useful out of the bullpen, which are honestly at this point probably not many. But no, I don't.
It's gonna be audition season for the bullpen.
I don't.
Like, Matt McGill, get out there.
Yeah, get on out there, Dan Altavilla. Come on down. I mean, that's. I don't expect to see a ton of movement one way or the other, honestly. Except, I think there are a lot of clubs that are short on pitching or are coming up on pitching emergencies that could be desperate enough to take some of our guys. So that's the movement I'd expect to see if there is any movement.
Yeah, I think McGill is the most, like, if you're just looking at the roster, I think Matt McGill is the most likely player to be traded for a positive return of some sort. He's just been a good reliever since being in Seattle and has looked this year like a good reliever his entire time. Like, he just is the only person that's super trustworthy in the bullpen right now. Taiwan only having 1 year, I wonder how teams will look at that, especially if they're trading for a guy in a, like, kind of weird season. Will people treat it as serious? Is he a guy a team would want to trade for and start in a playoff game? Like, what would, you know, does a team trade for a rental in a season where the playoffs could abruptly end due to factors out of their control? Like, how does that, you know, affect their interest? I will say with Seeger, I think the point you touched on, Kate, about specifically being at a position that is really deep right now is a underrated one, in addition to sort of the poison pill component. Like, almost every contending or would-be contending team right now has a good third baseman. Like, you know, the Yankees, the you know, the Cubs, the Twins, the White Sox, the A's, the Astros, the Rockies, the Dodgers, like every single major sort of contending club has a really rock solid guy. Even, you know, the Angels, like Seager probably is the fourth best third baseman in the division. So unless you find a club that either has an injury or like is the Braves, and the Braves really, really don't believe in Austin Riley and say, screw it, we'll take this veteran for the next 2 years. That's really the only way that I could see a team saying, okay, we'll pay the money on this guy because this is a clear, huge upgrade for us and we need to win.
Do either of you know Kyle Seager's middle name? I've just discovered Durr. It. And I was, yeah, what the hell is that?
Yeah,
D-U-E-R-R.
Kyle Durr Seager.
Is that how it's pronounced? No. Durr?
Durr? I'm sure, you know, my dad's middle name is... I should not say that because maybe that's like a social security question thing. Anyway, my dad's middle name is a family name. That so I assume that Durr is probably a middle name, a family name. And also, Kyle, change that or don't let people know that or something. Because, yeah, I feel like people could hack his life with that.
You think yeah, Kyle Seager's a 1-2-3-4 birthday?
Oh my god! I think Kyle Seager's password is probably password. So yes,
I thought he was a no internet guy.
Yeah, I was gonna say my joke was he just has converted all of his payment into gold bars that are in the basement. They're like buried underneath the pool in his North Carolina home.
It's not built yet, so. Though. It's not done. Like, and also, well, I think his
had
wife
to build the underground complex.
His wife is savvy enough. Protect Julie, I think Julie is savvy enough that she'll take care of all that. I bet she's fixed things. But yes, if left to his own devices, I think Kyle Durr Seager would be the most hackable person on the planet.
Which we do not condone, by the way. Please do not go hacking Kyle Seager's
no,
finances.
Please don't.
We need to convince him to stick around. It would be really fun if whenever this wave crests and the Mariners have either their next playoff team or just a good, exciting young team. If it's like all the young guys plus old man Seager, like I would love that. Just personally, I think Kyle Seager would love that too. But who knows? I can't claim to know anything about a man whose middle name is Durr. So let's go last question and get out of here. We got one from Anthony Peck, who is talking defense. I love it. He says, who do you think plays center field when both Kelenic and Lewis are on the roster? I think most of us, myself for sure, were surprised to see Kyle Lewis as the everyday center fielder this year. I thought Malik Smith would just kind of have that on legacy and just having more center field experience in the big leagues. But Lewis has seemed to do all right. I saw the clip of him robbing the home run. Correct me if I'm wrong. Both of you were much more tuned in than I am. But Kelenic has been playing center field in the minors, right? Whereas Lewis came up as mostly a corner outfielder and then got here. And they were like, center field it is. So you would think that the natural center fielder, Kelenic, would be the candidate there. But I want to know what you think after what we've seen from Lewis so far.
They did, like many minor league outfielders, the trick with Lewis was everyone viewed him, who watched him was generally thinking he will need to move to right field, but teams tend
because
to
he's very large, like
in center field.
It's because Lewis is large. He's a large human. He's like, yeah, what, 6'5"?
He looked like an Olympic volleyballer going up to rob that homer, where he backed up to the wall, jumped straight up, like both and two hands up, and just like caught it like, you know, like your dad was telling you to catch the ball properly when you're four, like squeeze it with two hands now. Like, you know, if he was going up to like defend a shot in basketball, like it would not have been a foul. Like that was clean, arms were straight up. Like it was fabulous.
The Roy Hibbert.
Yeah, exactly. So Kelnick was viewed as more likely to stay, but they both were playing a lot of center field. Lewis just, I mean, because of how much his injuries and the rehab from his injuries hampered him, he didn't ever really look that fluid. And it just was like, okay, well, he's probably going to be a right fielder. And he was already probably going to be a right fielder, as Kate said, because he was so big. I still would say Kelnick's a more likely center fielder, but they're not. Kelnick's just faster. I mean, that's really what that comes down to. You know, Lewis hasn't looked great or bad out there. I think he would probably be okay as long as he sort of maintains his athleticism. But at some point, I think you will see him and Kelnick sort of trade off potentially somewhat, maybe next year. And I would guess Kelnick gets more of those reps.
I agree. Cool. I think Kelnick is, just because he's smaller, he's speedier, he's rangier. And also, I think Kelnick just has a really good sense of how to read balls in the air. Like, he makes a lot of stuff look easier than I think it is. He's gifted in center field, so... when I watched Kelnick coming up as a prospect, I watched him play corner outfield because he wasn't one of the elite center fielders. And I think that, like, at the Perfect Game National Classic at Petco Park in 2018 or whatever it was. And so I developed this idea that Kelnick wasn't a center fielder, but I think that's wrong. That's very wrong. And it's a good example of like why you shouldn't determine a player's ceiling off of showcases because they're playing it. So Kelnick, I think, is a perfectly acceptable center fielder in the major leagues. It's just he wasn't in a showcase environment. Like, there were guys who were rangier and better than him, but who don't have his, I think, batting profile. So yeah, I like Kelnick for center personally.
Yeah, I think it's kind of, I mean, it is sort of the situation where it's like none of the current like dream center field or dream outfielders the Mariners have right now are like, oh wow, this guy's going to rob the ball all the time and like make incredible plays in the outfield kind of guys. It is, you know, it's two guys who you think, okay, either of these guys are going to be perfectly acceptable in center field, and that's not, you know, you're not going to have any issue one way or the other.
Well, I mean, Bishop is by far the best. Bishop is your sure, Kevin
but,
Kiermaier.
But I wouldn't consider him. Right.
But yeah, but the
I'm
bat.
I'm thinking like Lewis, Kelnick, and Julio, Fraley. Like of those three, who would be the like, right, but like the guys who are expected to be the starters, you know, if you're looking at like the guys, you know, those three, you know, you have the Bishop and maybe, you know, maybe Fraley, where it's like, okay, well, these guys maybe can play center a little bit better. I don't know about Bailey for that, but certainly Bishop. But the whole package, if you're putting your best three guys out there in a couple of years, it's probably Kelnick, Lewis, Rodriguez, and what is the center, you know, who is the true center
right.
fielder of those? I think it's more sort of split there right now. But we have a couple of years to figure it out.
Yeah, and beyond that, there's Class A hanging out there, who is a true, I think, that's center fielder, hanging out a couple years below them.
Yeah. And Dylan Moore might just take the spot, because I guess he's just great.
Yeah, Dylan Moore just hit a double. Dylan Moore!
Fucking Dylan Moore.
Where does it come from, Dylan Moore?
I am thrilled that... We're going to have to do a whole episode. It's going to be like an episode of Unsolved Mysteries, and it's just like us trying to like dig into Dylan Moore's power. Like, it is outrageous.
Like charts and graphs. Charts and graphs on the booty, because I don't, it's not even a big booty. Like, where does it come from, Dylan Moore? I do appreciate that his family, I mean, by this I mean his sister, appears to have taken it up and thinks it's funny. So I'm glad, I'm super glad that the Moore family finds it as amusing and perhaps confounding as I do. Honestly, though, there are not a lot of women broadcasters. Put me out there. No one is talking. I will guarantee you no one is talking about Dylan Moore's butt. It's a subject I feel like is in the interest of the populace. Someone needs to tell this truth.
We get through the stories. Yeah.
Let Kate talk about butts on TV. I've been saying it for years.
Hashtag let Kate talk about butts on TV. Oh my God. Yes.
Yeah, we're going to have to clean that one up.
No, it's good. This is the campaign we needed, and we'll check back next week to see if it's taken off. Hopefully it'll have trended several times over and become a write-in candidate in the 2020 election. We're going to need to do some grassroots campaigning, but I think if anyone can do it, it's us three. And with the power of Dylan Moore behind us, anything is possible.
That's true, and we mean behind us.
Exactly. Hate to see him go, but love to watch him play baseball. We'll work on that, too. We'll figure out a campaign slogan. So
it's dark. Anywho, sorcery. It's dark sorcery.
It is. It really is. If anyone wants to write a fan post, actually, that would be a great place to start on how Dylan Moore manages to hit the shit out of the ball despite looking like a solid piece of driftwood that has been like waterlogged and is like one swift kick away from falling apart, but it's still holding up real well. But anyway, thank you as always for those who sent in questions. Again, sorry for the delay while I went to find myself in Idaho and came back mostly empty-handed with a speeding
ticket.
That's
all right. You're just like in your own John Krakauer novel. I appreciate. I honor your journey.
John Krakauer, I know who that is. Thank you
contribution.
There's an alternative name for this book.
No, John Krakauer. That's like the Into the Wild guy, is it not?
I think that's London.
I believe that's Jack
London. No!
You managed to pick a book that I've actually...
Yeah. This is not doing much for my
Come on, it's that guy who writes all that about Chris McCandless. Come on.
You know who I'm talking about. It is a story by John Krakauer. Yeah, Into Thin Air.
Into Thin Air. Okay.
I was thinking of Call of the Wild.
Yeah. Yeah, Call of the Wild. He also wrote Into the Wild. Stop gaslighting me.
Kate, I don't know. Books don't even exist where I'm from.
Was us being wrong.
Yes, you're right. But you both tried to. Obviously,
listen,
anyway.
In the words of DMX, "Shorty can't eat no books." And that's how I feel.
Matthew, I thought that you would get this after the release of Folklore and like the Walden like retreat.
Fine. That released while he was in the fucking woods.
Never mind. It's like, just me over here on my Walden.
You're ranging towards extreme white people shit as well. Taylor Swift and books about the woods.
Taylor Swift and John Krakauer on the worst AP English course ever. It's fair.
Okay, well, if we're not canceled by next week for
as we should be
for assigning extremely whitewashed material, which I mean Dylan Moore is in there, but I think, you know, if we did specific research on his butt, if there's anything that
he has a Puerto Rican wife
has taught him about the power. Yeah,
he walks
say,
up to Bad Bunny. Feel like Dylan Moore is an ally.
Maybe she's taught him like the power of the hips, you know, a famously ignored group by white people, but the Caribbeans had it on lock
for a while, so maybe
that's been part of it. So yeah, do some research on that to all of our listeners. We would love to just maybe do a whole episode of questions about Dylan Moore. So if you want to cue those up for us, we are the group that can handle this.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're not getting this from the mainstream media. They don't want you to hear about Dylan Moore's butt. No.
But we do. We, of course, are Lookout Landing. Follow everything on lookoutlanding.com. You can follow Lookout Landing on Twitter. You can follow me at mroberson22. Kate and John are just at their names, Kate Prusser and John Troopin. And until next time, I mean, follow all of your local speed laws, I guess, and continue to watch.
Or maybe just don't drive 98. Maybe just that, Matthew.
To do that would be to obey the speed law, which is what I said. So whatever that means to you, I guess, listener, find your speed is going to be the tagline for this podcast. And I hope you listen in the future. We will talk to you whenever we talk to you next. I have no trips to Idaho planned, so we should be on a fairly regular schedule. But do not quote me on that. And, yeah, good friggin' bye. Years, days, makes no difference to